You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. I'm going to do a little solo act today that's going to kind of piggyback off of a blog post I wrote, got published on Tuesday of this week. So I was fortunate enough where one of my online athletes is from Germany, and I was able to get some pretty, I think, generic Dietmar Wolf programs. There were three or four of them in there, and I was able to view a training blog, actually, of somebody who is coached by him. So I got to see some of the ways in which the Norwegian national team programs their stuff. And it got me thinking quite a bit, because obviously with my coach being Boris Shiko, there are a lot of similarities between what Dietmar does and what Boris does, but there's also some differences at the same time. And I think it's important to kind of go over the benefits of submaximal training. So if you go on Instagram right now, I guarantee you, if you just scroll through, you follow a powerlifting hashtag, you're basically going to see a bunch of people that are really pushing the limits. So, you know, submax training is supposed to be using weights that are heavy enough to force adaptation, but they're not maximal weight. There's always a rep or two at least in reserve. But if you go on Instagram, you actually watch people lift. A lot of their everyday training tends to be 9 or 10s. Like, there's a lot of effort and a lot of strain going into training, and that's not necessarily what I want to see as a coach or what want to see my lifters doing. And don't get me wrong, there is a time and a place for that, but I do feel the internet shows too much of that stuff going on. And the Eastern Europeans have been doing this for a long period of time. Also, when it came down to them developing research, they don't quite care as much about human rights as us, I would say. So a lot of the research that was done probably wouldn't even be allowed here. And they value the strength sport. So a lot of their research actually focuses on improving qualities to get better powerlifters. So they've been doing this stuff for a long time, and I don't think anybody's actually done it better. So let's kind of dive into the importance of using submaximal training with your powerlifting program. So the number one thing, using the right weights allows the lifter to optimize technique. So strength is a skill, but so are the actual lifts themselves. And to get better at them, we need to make sure we're practicing proper technique. I think this is definitely one of the areas that is often overlooked by coaches and other lifters. It comes down to more about the weight on the bar than it is actually about executing the lift properly and building it up over time. So if we develop optimal technique, our ceiling for the best lifts that we could possibly do in our career is going to be its highest. The second it starts to break down and we start getting stronger in less than optimal positions, it's only going to get you so far. And don't get me wrong, in some cases it can get you very far. But if you took a minute, backed off a little bit, worked on technique, built it up from there, chances are you're going to actually do better in the long run than you are in the short term. So the Eastern Europeans actually believe that the lifts being a skill themselves, that if there's breakdowns within the lifts or you see sticking points, that it's not necessarily due to weak muscles. So let's take, for example, a common technical flaw. So somebody who squats and their knees are caving in, their chest is falling forward on the way up. So your typical, this is very common. So especially under heavier loads. So in a lot of cases, you might hear a coach say, you know, we need to do stuff that's going to strengthen your hip abductors and external rotators. Your glutes need to be stronger. Your back needs to be stronger. So they might throw in a bunch of accessory work to strengthen those weak muscles. Now, there's nothing wrong with actually doing this because, you know, maybe they do have some weaknesses from training in poor positions over a period of time. So throwing that accessory work that kind of focuses on those weak areas is not necessarily wrong. However, it's a secondary piece to a much larger issue. Their skill level within the lift just sucks. So oftentimes what I see is when I have a lifter that their skill level is extremely low, they've just been training poorly for a period of time, basically lifting too heavy too often and exceeding what their body's skill level is within the lifts themselves. So what we want to see is we want to analyze their lift and break it down. So if their knees are caving in and their chest is falling forward, it doesn't necessarily mean they're weak muscles. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's on the transition period that they're having the difficulty. Oftentimes what I'll see is a lifter, especially a newer lifter, they'll at the very start of the squat, they'll push their hips back too far, which causes the bar to start to float forward. And then when they go to reverse directions in that bar, remember, gravity is always engaged, so it's always pulling that bar down. So as they go down and that bar floats forward in front of the middle of their foot, when they go to stand back up, gravity is still pushing that bar down and it pushes their chest a little bit more forward. So there are still a lot of myths that kind of exist out there that I think were around from the dark ages of powerlifting, to steal a quote from Nick Yadis, which he was discussing how this was kind of like, you know, the 90s basically of powerlifting, where there's a lot of multiply stuff going on, and that's basically where a lot of the information was coming from. So the whole sit back cue on the squat was a big one. And when I first started squatting, I had trained with a group of multiply lifters and they were telling me the same thing. To sit back, weight on your heels. So when that bar floated forward, going down, chest caves forward, you know, and it just becomes a poor loss of position. So it doesn't necessarily mean that when we see those technical defaults that it's from that point where you actually see the problem arising. So you do need to watch the entire squat. And what we need to analyze is we need to analyze where it's breaking down, and we need to put in the right variations to fix those issues. So let's keep the very first one, the hips getting pushed back, the bar floating forward. This is a variation that Borishiko has used a lot with me, and I use a lot with my lifters in these cases, is we'll pause on the halfway down. So this is a variation I've used for a couple of reasons. The primary one is a lot of times, especially as weights get heavier, the lifter will start to kind of hit the brakes as they enter the hole instead of picking up speed. So pausing on the halfway down lets them focus, regroup, and then the goal is from that pause to be faster on that second half of that eccentric motion than they were in the first half, to start learning how to pick up speed in and out of the bottom position of the squat. But it also works well in this situation where that lifter's pushing their hips back, the bar is floating forward. If that bar gets forward enough, pausing there with 70-75% sucks. They just absolutely won't be able to do it. So they're going to have to kind of figure it out. So it gives them that experience. And obviously, you know, I'm there watching and giving them feedback to know what that first part of that squat is supposed to feel like. And then from there, we're working on the rest of it. So let's also take a lifter with that same technical default of the knees caving in and the chest falling forward out of the hole. You know, oftentimes when we go to reverse direction, sometimes there's just kind of sheer panic. Like, it's heavy, the lifter kind of panics, and all their thoughts just kind of go into standing up. And that's fine. I think this is more of a fault that you see in more like novice lifters or intermediates that are starting to get into some bigger weights. And all they need to do is they just need to learn how to stand their ground and practice heavier weights. So in this case, pause squats would be a nice addition. So pause in the hole 2-3 seconds. I like using something substantial, 70-75%. It will actually work these up to some heavier singles at like 80-ish percent over time, just to develop that same effort from the bottom, learning how to stand their ground and getting comfortable in those positions, which kind of takes away some of the panic. It also helps, you know, keeping the knees out and everything else. Now for the chest falling forward part, a lot of people will blame the quads for this, and they'll try to, you know, hammer away accessories at the quads. And the quads are an important muscle group, so adding in accessories to build your quads is probably never a bad idea. But in the squat, what we're looking for is that at the bottom position, we want our glutes and our quads to extend the hips and extend the knees, and the back muscles need to stay tight the entire time, and there is back extension going on as we come up too. So we want all of those muscles to be working together. And what's happening when they go to reverse directions, it's not. For some reason, they're getting a bunch of knee extension without the hips really extending, hence the chest falling forward. So this shifts a lot of weight back onto the hamstrings. So we don't want the hamstrings doing basically much, if anything, at all in the squat. Since they cross two joints, they extend the hips and they also flex the knee. So one of the things that we're trying to do is extend the knee. So we don't really want the hamstrings to engage because there's a cost associated with it, because they're going to try to flex the knee. What we want is we want that basically the hamstrings, they stiffen up and they allow force to be transferred between the glutes and the quads. So the timing of the squat, so the knee extension and hip extension can be the same. And we obviously want the back muscles to remain tense and the chest to remain upright. So in these cases, I use pin squats as an example of an accessory in these positions. They tend to work really well because if you're dead stopped on pins like that and you're getting into that shitty position, that bar will not move off of the pin. So the lifter, again, will have to kind of figure it out to be able to move the weight. And then lastly, like in these situations, a variation I like to use would be something that affects tempo. So you'll see a lot of people use like straight out tempo squats, you know, 2 seconds down, 1 second pause, 2 seconds up. I've done 3 seconds down, 0 second pause in the hole, 3 seconds up. What I actually like about this too is it kind of goes back to what I was talking about when you see a lifter experience a little bit of panic coming up. It kind of teaches them to stand their ground a little bit because the time under tension on the way up is going to be, you know, similar to what they're going to experience under heavier weights. And it just kind of gets them used to being in those positions for a relative period of time. What I also like about it too, I like making sure that on the way up, the concentric phase, that there is some type of tempo to it, is it takes out that stretch shortening cycle. So the squat on the way down, your muscles are kind of like rubber bands. So they're stretching. If you hit the hole with speed, which is why we want to hit the hole with speed, you get that quick elastic rebound from the muscles and you get that stretch shortening cycle, which carries the weight, you know, a little bit out of the hole. And you'll see it. So if you watch like a really heavy squat, a lot of times you'll see somebody get some good pop out of the hole, and then it looks like the brakes just get slammed on and they start to slow down. So that's kind of where the stretch shortening cycle kind of took them to, and then their strength's not able to get them past that point. So the tempo squats actually remove that stretch shortening cycle and kind of build an area of the squat that they probably don't tend to focus on very often. Pin squats do that a little bit too, as long as you're resting the weight on the pins. So, and lastly, to affect tempo, what we can do is we can just institute pauses in the places in which the lifter is actually failing the lifts. Because, so for this case, let's say squat with a pause on the halfway up. So as they exit the bottom position of the squat, they're going to move a little bit slower because they know they have to pause on the halfway up. So it just allows them to focus on their technique, removes the stretch shortening cycle a little bit. And oftentimes when you see somebody's, we'll just use the knees caving in this case, and you institute that pause and you're controlling that tempo a little bit, you don't see those technical issues, which goes back to my initial point. It's not weak muscles that are causing that. It's just poor skill level within the lift. And the law of specificity even applies. So if you're trying to fix something within the lift, the angles, the forces, the speeds need to be as similar as possible as to what they're going to be dealing with on the platform in order for it to have maximal carryover. So you need to make sure you're practicing this stuff within the lifts, which submaximal training, putting the right weight on the bar for the right amount of sets, the right amount of reps, and utilizing the right variations to fix the weak areas within the lifts. This is basically kind of the foundation of working with Boroshiko, where technique is what he talks about being the most important aspect within the lift. And that doesn't mean we just lower weights because something looks like shit. It means that the lift itself, and strength itself is a skill, and we need to institute the right drills and do the right things in order to enhance the skill to the best of our abilities. We do want every single repetition to look as the same. The goal of this, we're trying to build a stable movement pattern. So the more stable the movement pattern, and when we go to a meet and we try to maximally stress it out, it's going to be hard to break down because it's a stable pattern. But let's say we go into the gym and we're just all over the place all the time on the squats because we want to lift heavy. We want to get a few extra followers on Instagram. What happens in these cases, so say you're doing a heavy set of five, and all five of them look different, you've basically trained five different movement patterns. And the problem with this is once you go to maximally stress it out on the platform with higher loads, it's going to be hit or miss because, you know what, it's already broken down under lighter loads. So once you put heavier loads on it, it's just going to continue to break down. This is where you'll see, you know, somebody getting pitched so far forward, the squats are higher, and then they'll be arguing with the judge that it was depth. You'll see a lot of these issues begin to arise. You know, and don't get me wrong, it can be frustrating to use lighter weights all the time. To be honest, we only look for 2.5 to 7 kilo PRs on each of the lifts every competition. We're not looking for that big 20, 30, 40 pound PR. That's not the goal. We want to develop the skill over time so that over the career of the lifter, we're seeing their maximal results that they're possibly capable of putting on the platform. And also, this is a hobby that they pay for. I don't feel comfortable enough really pushing somebody to a point where they could risk injuring themselves and missing work days, because at the end of the day, this is nothing more than a hobby that we care about and we're very serious about, but it's also a hobby. So using submax weights, like in a Chico program, we very rarely go over 85%. And the reason for this is because once you start getting up into those 85 percentile ranges, you start to see breakdowns in technique. And when we do go up into those 90% ranges, you'll see deadlift off blocks, because shortening the range of motion, the lifter tends to have better technique in those areas. We'll use a slingshot or boards on bench press to get up there for the same reason. It shortens the range of motion, so the technique ends up staying on point. It becomes very difficult to do this for squats. We'll overload with chains, not bands, on the squats, but it kind of is what it is, and you can make it more difficult by pausing using pin squats. So if we're pausing for doubles or triples at 75% on the squat, it's much more difficult than 75% intensity because of the pause. So we can kind of use variations to manipulate the effort, which at the end of the day, that's what we want, right? We're putting a certain weight on the bar for a certain amount of repetitions to get a certain amount of effort in order to transfer over to maximal strength adaptation. So with the squat, you gotta get a little bit more creative in order to get that effort. And that effort that I'm talking about is referred to as exertion load. So the effort of each repetition is kind of included in this. So let's say we're doing a set of 10, and in order to do 4 or 5 sets of 10, maybe you're using 60-65%. So the first 4 or 5 reps are too easy to actually, the effort's just not there in order to increase strength maximally. So this is why with Chico, we tend to use a lot of repetition ranges between 3 and 6 reps, which tends to be kind of the sweet spot, with 1 to 2 reps in reserve. That's kind of like what we're looking for, with consistent technical effort on top of it. When I was looking at Dietmar's programs, it actually seems like his average intensities are a little bit lower. So he's also a big proponent of submax training. It's very, very similar, like I was saying. But his average intensities are lower, but his frequency is higher. So what we see with me, I squat twice a week, I deadlift twice a week, and I bench 3 to 4 times. In Dietmar's programs, they squat, they bench, and they deadlift every single training day. So if, say I was one of his lifters on a 4-day template, I would squat all 4 days, bench all 4 days, deadlift all 4 days. But the volumes and the number of lifts are very, very, very similar. So what I think we're seeing is he's just taking the same, Dimar is just taking the same amount of volume and stretching it out over a longer period of time. And both of these programs are extremely successful for each of their respective countries. So at the end of the day, the most important thing is making sure you're getting the right amount of volume in order to lead to strength adaptations. But what happens with volume is we're building fatigue, right? So if we're lifting heavy all the time, you're probably not getting as much volume as you think. Training's hard and you can get stronger, but you're not really accumulating a lot of volume. Just because of sheer fatigue that comes in. And volume is important to build strength. I think the majority of us understand that, but it's also important to build a foundation to keep a healthy athlete over a period of time. So volume builds tissue tolerance. It builds work capacity as well as strength. So it's an extremely important component. And I actually keep track of volumes utilizing the acute chronic work ratio. So I've explained this on a couple podcasts and written some articles about it. Its primary function is utilized within team sports. However, I think it has a very positive role for me in monitoring an athlete's training volume. Basically what it does is it gives me a snapshot of their fitness and their fatigue. So the chronic workload is a rolling 28-day average. So the previous 4 weeks are averaged out for how much total weight lifted within a 7-day period. So, you know, just for very simple math, these are not real volumes. If I have a 4-week block and we've done 12,000 total pounds of volume in those 4 weeks, you take 12,000 divided by four, my average, my chronic workload would be 3,000 pounds. So if I wanted to do 4,000 pounds in a given week, that's over the baseline for this lifter. So that's kind of how we drive change. The ratio that I tend to look for is anywhere between 0.8 and 1.3. This is the value that seems to be appropriate for the majority of team sports. So I've just kind of adopted it and it tends to work extremely well for my lifters. So 1.0 would be their baseline level of volume. So this is the volume that this lifter is averaging out over that last 4 week period. They can handle that, recover from it, no problem. Anything over that, we're getting above baseline, and the further over it that we get, the harder it is going to be for that lifter to recover. And anything under baseline is going to be, it's basically a recovery week once we get underneath 1.0. Quick caveat, there are other things that drive fatigue. The novelty of a new exercise. So if we're putting a variation in that the lifter hasn't done before, it's going to be more stressful. If we're doing sets, reps at a given intensity that we haven't done before, it's going to be more stressful. The closer we get to failure on given sets, it's going to be harder to recover from. It's going to be more stressful. So there are other factors that come into play with this. So you could actually have a baseline week of around 1.0 volume wise, but adding in a lot of new exercises can make that week more difficult and actually stress the athlete a little bit. So what we're actually looking for is, over the bigger picture, we want to coordinate large, medium, and small load days and weeks. So there tends to be, in a given week, 1 to 2 high stress days, 1 to 2 medium stress days, and I tend to throw usually a recovery day in at least every 2 weeks, if not every week. The day 4 tends to be a lighter deadlift day. And in most cases, this is not always the case. If I'm looking for, and we're doing this at a larger picture too. So if I'm looking for a larger week this week, I might bench and have some deadlift volume on that day 4 where the previous weeks I didn't. And that's kind of how I can drive a week well over baseline for accumulated volume. So with the weeks, we want the same thing. We want some at baseline, some above baseline, and some below baseline for recovery. So anything above baseline drives adaptation, at baseline helps maintain it, and below it It's for recovery. So this is how we get steady progress over time while keeping the lifter as healthy as humanly possible. And don't get me wrong, things happen. People get injured, but it is this is the best that we can do. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to build fatigue over a period of time while obviously keeping the lifter healthy. And this fatigue drives adaptation, allows the lifter to get stronger. So if you're in training and every week you're coming in and you're hitting a PR, chances are there is not enough volume in there that's really driving maximal adaptation. Because that fatigue literally should be driving down what you're capable of hitting in the gym. So if you are PRing every week, it might be a good idea to take a look at the volumes that you're hitting in training, and kind of, there are plenty of charts out there. Shikos is public on his site of recommended volumes and stuff. And remember, volume is not just important to get stronger. It's important to build tissue resiliency and build an optimal athlete that is capable of staying healthy. I think the majority of us know that too much volume can actually increase injury risk. But there's a reason why with the acute chronic work ratio that volume, that they don't have volume dip below 0.80, because too little volume also increases injury risk, because the athlete kind of becomes less fit and is less capable of handling the workload that's going to be placed in front of them. Because once that acute workload gets too high over that chronic workload, we can run into some issues. So if you're constantly PRing in training, take a look at your volumes and kind of compare them to the recommended volumes of Dietmar Wolf has some too. I'm pretty sure they're on the internet, and Chico's are definitely on his site. And with the lighter weights, we're doing all of these things. And for me, I don't touch 90% in a program until a peaking block, which tends to be pretty close to a meet. I do think there are some benefits. So I'm not as against taking heavy singles occasionally in training blocks as maybe Dietmar and Borishiko are. I think there are some benefits, especially to newer lifters. I think the benefits extend far beyond the skill of the lift and kind of start going more into the psychological piece for the lifter. However, I do think the skill of lifting over 90%, especially on a squat, on a deadlift and a bench, maybe I think those just become more strength issues. But because of the stability requirements on a squat, I think there is a skill to being able to squat heavy. So I think practicing that skill a few weeks out is important. And like I said, with Boris, I do touch 90% closer to a competition. I might touch it 1 to 2 times in the block or two leading up to my test. Then I'll test and obviously hit it there. And then on the platform, I'll hit it again. So there is a period of time where I'm touching it, working on that skill. Because remember, we're working on long-term development here, and competition is part of that long-term development. That's why my goal at every meet is not to miss repetitions, because those made repetitions at competitions are going to make me stronger over time. With my lifters, I tend to hit 90%. A little bit more frequently, but it's spread out and it's a little further away from competition, but it's still close to competition. So it would be in the peaking block. And I think, to be honest, like, my one theory is that it just builds psychological confidence, and that psychological piece is more important than I think a lot of people give it credit for. Actually, current research is showing that when you're strength training, that portion of your brain that basically controls your feelings lights up first before the part that controls your physiology. So your belief in a program and the coach, plays a major role in you developing strength. So I think in a lot of cases, it's important to add that in for the psychological benefit. And also, too, I think that the newer lifters need to kind of learn how to strain maximally. A lot of times they think they've hit a max, but there's probably more that could be added to the bar just because they haven't developed that quality yet. And I think lifting a little heavier helps them develop that quality, just because it brings in those psychological factors also. Because a double or triple at 85% is actually harder than a single at 90%. So the stress of 85% for 2 to 3 reps is actually higher. And that second or third rep is actually much harder than just a single at 90%. So I think, people tend to kind of forget about that. And that's kind of how Dietmar and Boris do their programs. You don't need to touch anything over 85% to develop those qualities, because you can get the same effort and the same stress at lighter weights without losing technique. And if you're not looking for 20, 30 pound PRs, and that's when you're going to start to see obviously a massive breakdown because a lifter has never touched weights that heavy before. But with that said, I don't think it's necessary to hit 90% from a physiological standpoint, but I do think the confidence of being able to touch those weights helps the lifter, especially on competition day too. They don't get as stressed out. They know that their first and second attempts are basically weights that they've hit so many times within training, that they have confidence to be able to hit it on the platform, and then you get the adrenaline on the third attempt and things tend to work out pretty well. And I think looking at how I was programming before and then adding in the 90%, I don't think it actually made us stronger. I think it just made us more confident. So on meet days, we've done a lot better in the last few meets of controlling our energy, of hitting third attempts, of hitting third attempt deadlifts too. So not just, getting that adrenaline dump after squats or bench or something and then gassing out on deadlifts. But it's been a lot more steady progress steady progress with our skill of competing, let's say. So I think the confidence on meet day has gone a long way, and I don't think it actually is necessary to make us stronger, but it kind of is at the same time. And, not only are the second and third reps at 85% harder than a single at 90%, but that accumulated fatigue that we're talking about. So if you're doing enough volume to accumulate enough fatigue, what's happening is your one rep max when you go into the gym actually gets lower because you're fatigued. So you're not capable of actually hitting your maxes that day. So you can utilize this accumulated fatigue throughout the week and use lighter weights to build, lighter, like those submaximal weights, to build more volume, to get higher efforts and get those strength adaptations while keeping the lifter healthy over a period of time. So I'm just gonna use an example here. Let's say day one, I come in the gym and I have a high stress squat day where I'm doing 70% for 5x6. On squats. So, it's 42 squats for me. That's a higher than average squat day. So that'd be a high stress day. And then let's say on day two, I come in and I have double deadlifts. So I do some deadlift to the knees, work up to 75% for 4 or 5 doubles. And then I have deadlift off blocks where I hit 80% for 2 triples, 90% for 3 doubles. In that case there, we're totaling roughly 30 deadlifts at around 72% average relative intensity once you include the warm-ups, which is a pretty high stress deadlift day. And this had come after a pretty high stress squat day. So that stress of day one definitely will affect that deadlift day on day two. So now I'm pretty stressed. My body is pretty fatigued. I tend to, in these cases, have a lighter squat day. So I might have something working on technique. So let's say I'm going to pause on the halfway down on the squats to get faster going into the hole. I might work up to 75% for doubles. But already with the pause, a 2 second pause on the halfway down, that 75% requires more effort because of that time under tension. But also because of the accumulated fatigue on days one and days two, that 75% is actually probably higher for what my one rep max would be at that given day. So my one rep max squat is 445. 75% of 445 when I'm fresh, right? 75%, in order to hit 445, I need to be fresh. On that given day, let's say, you know, I might be 5% weaker. I might be 10% weaker. So maybe the most I could hit on that day might be around 420. So now 75% becomes a much higher percentage of what I'm actually capable of lifting that day because of accumulated fatigue. So remember, this gets back to exertion load. So the effort is still there, but the load is controlled to keep the athlete from getting injured. And we're still able to build volume. And then day four, I might have some type of deadlift variation also. And at this point, I'm probably pretty tired in the week. And that deadlift variation will feel harder on day four than it would have if I had done it fresh. So like I said, you shouldn't be able to hit PRs all the time in training. It just shouldn't happen. So if you actually go back and you look at your program, make sure the volumes are there. And if you're doing volume right and you're organizing the structure of your program properly, those sub-maximal weights add up to accumulate fatigue over time to make the lifts more difficult, requiring more effort. So for those of you who use RPE, it would increase the RPEs at lower relative intensities to drive the same strength adaptations without constantly having to, you know, deal with injuries or anything else that you tend to see from people who tend to just push weight on the bar all the time to drive intensity. There is a science and kind of an art to organizing the structure of programs like this, and it's something that I'm still learning because it's a lot more complex than I think people in a lot of cases want to give it credit for. And keeping in mind the technical proficiency of the lifter, like you add that all in. So for me, it seems to be a win if I can drive intensity high enough to force strength adaptation, because your body doesn't know weight on the bar. It only knows effort. So if I can drive that effort with lighter weights while keeping technique the same, it seems like a win than if I'm just going to constantly drive volumes and intensities on a week to week basis without keeping track of other variables. And don't get me wrong, if you drive volumes and you drive intensities continuously over time, especially if you drive volumes and intensities, let's say on a week-to-week basis or bi-weekly basis, you can get really strong, really fast. But I've written about this before, but buyer beware, because that acute chronic work ratio gets thrown completely out of whack because your tissues and stuff aren't used to those volumes yet and haven't built that work capacity to be able to keep handling load. And at some point, there is going to be a breaking point. Also, if you're constantly increasing load and intensity in a very small scale like that, your technique, right? In a small scale, I mean like week to week, your technique's going to break down pretty quick because, you know, if you're already at 80% starting there and technique starts to break down over, you know, at 85% or a hair higher, you're going to get there pretty quick. The majority of your training block's going to be with shitty technique. And don't get me wrong, you can lift a lot of weight with shitty technique, but if you had really good technique over time, you'd lift more. You probably just won't get as strong as fast. And also too, like from a health standpoint, like biomechanics is not a final factor in whether you're going to get injured or not. There are plenty of people with terrible technique that don't experience injuries. It's going to be controlling that volume and making sure that acute chronic work ratio stays in check. But also, if you're trying to increase volume over time and your knees are strained, your back is round by the time the bar actually breaks the floor in a deadlift, the majority of that volume is being done by your back muscles. You're not going to be able to handle as much. The tissue tolerance of just your back is going to be a lot less than if you added your quads and your glutes with some more knee and hip extension in there. So the more joints that you can actually put that weight over, the more healthy you're going to be over time just from being able to handle the volume. Three joints, and obviously there's way more joints working than this, but for, you know, simple viewing, three joints is going to, they're going to be able to handle much more volume than if you're just putting it onto one. So, you know, I think it's interesting because I'm coached by an Eastern European coach, a Russian coach, and the way I train and the way that I see a lot of my fellow Americans here train is very different. And obviously, the Americans are doing extremely well. Just look at their results in Worlds, but I will be interested to kind of see where some of these lifters are 3, 4, 5 years down the road. You know, and I could be wrong. And if that's the case, we'll make the adjustments necessary to get people stronger. But what we're doing now is working, so we'll continue to do it. I've written a lot of articles on the acute chronic work ratio, submaximal training. You can get on the website. So it's precisionpowerlifting.com. There's a little blog tab. I do encourage you to go through that. There have been a few podcasts that I've done going over these topics. I encourage you to listen to those. I encourage you to listen to the Coach's Corner too, because Zach and Ryan are extremely knowledgeable. I've done this for an extremely long period of time, and they have some really good insights into a lot of this stuff. And even though, and the good thing is too, is the three of us, we coach. There's a lot of similarities, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of differences as well. So you can kind of, you know, any lifter out there, if you listen to those, one of us is probably going to line up pretty well with you, with your coach, and you'll be able to kind of pick up what we're saying and maximize your programming and results. Follow me on Instagram at KWCan. Follow our team at Precision Powerlifting Systems. Thanks, and stay strong, Boston.